I'm Charlie Sykes. So people ask me, how do you pick your guests for the Bulwark podcast? I actually, to tell you the truth, nobody's ever actually asked me that. But they really should, because sometimes we pick our guests based on the news of the day, sometimes because of something they've written that we think was provocative. Sometimes it's just somebody that I'd like to spend some time talking with. And sometimes it's because of a tweet. So over the weekend, you might have seen this. The usually reasonable and rational Ross Douthat wrote if that's how you pronounce his name, I always get that wrong, wrote a strange piece in the New York Times suggesting that maybe there was something to all those conspiracy theories suggesting the FBI had spied on and maybe even entrapped some members of the Trump team. So maybe the real scandal, it wasn't the Russian collusion, it was the deep state, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm reading this, and that morning, I'm doing what I do, which, of course, is, you know, tells you what kind of a life I have, that I'm looking at Twitter on a Sunday morning. And I ran across a tweet from Quinta Jurecek, who is the managing editor of Lawfare. And this is what she tweeted. The degree to which this argument has caught on among the respectable conservative pundits is unbelievably depressing. And it was, and it is. So that's who I'm talking with today. So thanks for spending some time with us, Quinta.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And I'm still depressed about that, by the way. So look, I want to talk about the conspiracy theories, but we've had so many other things break in the last day or so. We have the White House now asserting executive privilege over the entire Mueller report as part of the protection of Bill Barr against findings of contempt. We have more than 700 former federal prosecutors who've signed this letter saying that if Trump was anybody else in the world, he would have been charged with obstruction of justice. And then you have the New York Times with this amazing story, and I'm still pouring through the details of this, about how much money Donald Trump lost back in the 1980s. Look, any schmuck can lose $10,000 or $100,000, but it really takes a master of the universe to lose more than $1 billion in a 10-year period. So, Quinta, what do you want to talk about first? What should we jump into first?
Well, I'm happy to start with the conspiracy theories if that's where you want to begin.
Okay, let's do that. This is one of the things, and the key word in your tweet that really sort of slapped me was the respectable conservative pundits. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, the mooks from the Federalist or, you know, the cult 45 folks on Fox and Friends. It's guys who have been really reasonable up until now, and now they're buying into this, and you're seeing this on Capitol Hill as well, you know, that the real scandals, we now have to investigate the FBI. So talk to me about this notion that somehow we got the story all wrong, that the FBI actually planted this was part of this deep state coup conspiracy. And I share with you, I'm amazed at the number of people on the right, including elected officials, who seem to be taking this seriously.
Yeah, so this is a narrative that has been building and kind of fermenting in various forms. I would argue since that Trump tweet in 2017 accusing the Obama administration of tapping the wires in Trump Tower. And that kind of is the beginning of this idea that there was some kind of illicit surveillance, call it spying, perpetrated by the Obama administration, perhaps at the behest of the president himself, on the Trump campaign. And as you say, this has kind of been a mainstay of the more fevered corners, I would say, of conservative right-wing media, pro-Trump media, in various forms. And what I was really struck by is, as you say, how it's now showing up in the New York Times by Ross Douthat, who's a columnist who I would agree is sort of, you know, solidly in the category of respectable, right-leaning writer. And what I was struck by is how the column seemed to pick up on a lot of arguments that have been made by the less respectable folks and sort of took them at face value, took them as reasonable questions to ask. One example that jumped out at me right away is Douthat's suggestion that we should be concerned about Joseph Mifsud, who is the mysterious professor who met with Trump foreign policy aide George Papadopoulos.
Mysterious Maltese professor.
Yes, that's very important.
Even better.
And the FBI has stated, and Mueller has stated, that Mifsud was functionally an asset of the Russian government and was sort of passing information from the Russian government to Papadopoulos. What the column suggests is that Mifsud may be, quote, connected to Western intelligence rather than the Kremlin. If that were true, that would definitely be interesting. The problem is that George Papadopoulos himself has been peddling this story for over a year now, and I have yet to see any evidence. So it's really striking that it's now being put forward as a sort of a reasonable question for reasonable people to ask.
Yeah, and also you noticed that he quoted something from the Mueller report that did not even appear there. He in quotes the term "no proof of conspiracy," which, as you noted, does not appear in the Mueller report. What the report actually says is the special counsel did not establish coordination, and those are different things. So I want to go back to this whole question of the mainstreaming of the most bizarre theories. And you know, going back to 2017, when the president tweeted that the Obama administration had wiretapped, that was debunked rather forcefully and rather quickly. I mean, I think that was universally recognized as, I think the technical term here, you can correct me here, the technical term I think is bullshit.
Yep, that's exactly right.
And yet, it went underground and it kind of festered and it was sort of out there in the sewers of the fever swamp, and then it emerges into the fever swamp, and then other people go, well, I don't know, and you start seeing this among, you know, some of the conservative commentators, the usual suspect, and now it's sort of, you know, blossoming in, I'm searching for the right, you know, metaphor of, you know, something blossoming out of this swamp, and I wonder whether or not this is just a matter of the fact that we have been so inundated with all of this back and forth that people just don't know what to believe anymore. This annihilation of truth sort of thing that I've quoted Garry Kasparov as saying that the point of misinformation is not to convince you of A or B; it's to attack your critical sensibilities. It is the annihilation of truth, and so that people are going, I just don't know, and even really smart, thoughtful people are willing to say, well, maybe this is true. I mean, if you see it enough on Twitter, if you hear it enough on Fox News, if you read it enough, even in the pages of National Review, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I've been thinking over the last few days about an essay that I wrote in January 2018 about, if you remember, the Nunes memo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. About the Nunes memo. And the argument I was making then is basically the same as what you're quoting Kasparov as saying, that the goal with the Nunes memo was less to put forward a coherent alternate narrative of what happened during 2016 and more just to kick up dust and confuse people and sort of throw alternate possibilities into the air, even if they didn't add up. And that what this amounted to was basically a cycle of disinformation where congressional Republicans will voice a concern about something, about an alleged abuse of authority under President Obama, that'll get picked up in marginal media outlets. It'll then get picked up by more traditional reporters and Fox. Then Trump will tweet about it. Then Fox and Congress respond. And then you go back around and around again. And I think we're very much still in the thick of that cycle. And what struck me about the last couple months is that it really seems like the way I've described the cycle, it's mostly stayed within far right to conservative media and tends not to sort of jump out of the bloodstream into the mainstream media, whatever you want to call it, less Trump-friendly media, let's say. Whereas in recent months, after the release of the report, perhaps as a result of Attorney General Bill Barr's comments, I don't know, it really does seem to me like people who are much more toward the center right, much more skeptical of Trump, have been more open to these kinds of claims that have been running through that feedback loop for a couple of years now.
You know, this is what I was thinking about, and I'm sorry to keep quoting your tweets here, because you tweeted out, today is going to be hilarious and depressing, which I then realized was the second time you used the word depressing. And I actually, you know, find this weighing on me, this sort of the triumph of misinformation, or the just the sense of the futility, that no matter how much argumentation you put out, no matter how much facts, no matter how much debunking, it no longer matters. And is that what you mean by depressing? And I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it does feel like, you know, you are going into this hurricane of, and maybe it is post-factual world, maybe we're in the post-truth in environment, but to see this sort of thing continue to get traction does make you want to sort of throw up your hands and, I don't know, go off to Costa Rica and stare at the water or something.
I would say, yeah, I think I don't want to say that, you know, we're in the age of the death of truth or anything like that. But when I say that something is depressing, that's sort of what I mean, that it doesn't mean nothing to put factual information out there. It actually means a lot. But to sort of riff on your metaphor, it sort of feels like just shouting into a hurricane, right? So someone will hear you, but the hurricane is still going on.
That's a cleaner version of what I was going to say, like blanking into the hurricane, but shouting will do.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go. Exactly. That's the family-friendly version. And what I was commenting on this morning, the tweet that you referenced, was how Republicans are now responding to this amazing New York Times story about Trump's taxes and how they show just a mind-boggling amount of money that he lost, are now going on Fox News and saying, well, you know, he didn't really lose that much money, or it's good that he lost that much money, and that it's not a total disconnection from the facts, but it is a very utilitarian attitude toward the facts.
Well, it also represents, though, the world in which Donald Trump lives. I mean, he personally is without shame, but he also can count on other people to run interference with him, no matter how bad the story is, no matter what happens. There's always going to be, and I think you were referring to Newt Gingrich, who was saying he didn't lose $1 billion. He had $1 billion in losses, and in his head, I'm sure that made a lot of sense.
Yeah, but, I'm genuinely not clear on what the distinction is supposed to be there.
I think it probably is the argument that some of these quote-unquote losses are simply depreciation. Although any reading of the Times article or listening to the, you know, people who actually understand this will point out that, yes, depreciation is a fraction of those losses, but most of those losses were driven just by bad business decisions. And by the way, just to give a flavor of this, here's a little sample of what went on Fox and Friends, where they turned this into just another example of how just absolutely brilliant the Orange God King is as a businessman.
How did he make his money? Did he pay any taxes? That's what a lot of people would wonder about. It is an interesting look, though, at how New York City real estate developers worked in the 80s and the 90s.
If anything, you read this and you're like, wow, it's pretty impressive, all the things that he's done in his life. It's beyond what most of us could ever achieve.
But this is the story. You know, by the time, I'm just going to read it a little bit here. By the time his Master of the Universe memoir, Trump, The Art of the Deal, hit bookstores in 1987, Donald J. Trump was already in deep financial distress, losing tens of millions of dollars on troubled business deals, according to these previously unreleased figures from his federal income tax returns. And it goes out to talk, this is the fullest, most detailed look to date at the president's taxes, how many bad business deals he had. There are some extraordinarily, I think fascinating little details here, not just about how much money he lost back in the 1980s before. I mean, we knew that he lost money in the 1990s, but the way in which he had actually manipulated the stock market by pretending to, you know, by putting out the word he was going to take over the company and then having the stock rise and people, and he made some money doing all that until people figured out that it was, you know, that he was, again, I'm sorry to use the word again, bullshitting, you know, until investors realized that he wouldn't follow through. That much has been known for years, but the tax information obtained by the Times shows that he ultimately lost the bulk of the gains from his four-year trading spree. Now, I have to tell you, as somebody who remembers graphically what the 2016 primaries were like, the number of times I heard from Trump supporters or Trump curious voters that, well, he's such a successful businessman. That was a huge factor in his ethos. The reason he's president of the United States is because he became famous for allegedly being this successful business person. But what I also remember is how immune to information people were about all of the failures, whether it was Trump University or the Trump shuttle or Trump vodka or Trump steaks. None of that actually penetrated. This image of Donald Trump as this wildly successful master of the universe. And so you look at this, and my takeaway is Donald Trump, and we knew this, but Donald Trump has to be the most successful con man of all time. History does not have his equal in terms of just spreading this con out over decades, convincing people that he was something he wasn't, and parlaying that into becoming the most powerful man in the world. I mean, who else would be the most successful con man?
It's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that really struck me reading the Mueller report, specifically Volume 1, is Mueller again and again points to people on the campaign who told Mueller, or who seemed to have indicated, that they basically understood the Trump campaign as a way for Trump to gin up value for his brand and get some exposure. And the only person who really seems to have understood the campaign as a campaign functionally is Paul Manafort. But in a weird way, you're absolutely right that he sort of has arguably, yes, pulled a very successful con. And I think the sort of additional level of irony is that it's not even clear that he meant to do that in the first place in terms of winning the presidency.
Okay, so now this comes out, and the timing's interesting, of course, because there's this big fight brewing over whether or not to force him to release his income tax forms. And the law, we've discussed this on the podcast before, the law seems to be very clear that Congress has the ability to get those income tax forms, but they are going to the mat, absolutely, as part of the universal Stonewall strategy. They're refusing to do it. So this raises the question again. So what do you, and we're speculating here, what is the main reason that Donald Trump is so obsessed about blocking release of those tax funds? Is it that he's not as rich and successful as he wants people to think he is? Is it because he does have these shady business ties that might raise questions about his conflicts of interest or his influence? Or is it because it would expose a pattern of tax fraud and tax cheating? Thoughts?
Well, no one really knows, right? Which is, as you say, is sort of exactly the reason why it's important to ask the question in the first place. What I will say is that Daniel Hemmel, who is a law professor at the University of Chicago, pointed out this morning. So Trump tweeted this morning in response to the New York Times story, basically saying, well, on the one hand, you know, this is a lie by the failing New York Times, but on the other hand, everyone did it. And basically describing the scheme that you've laid out there. And what Daniel Hemmel argues on Twitter is basically that, here, and I'll just quote the tweet, the president is pretty much saying that he used transactions without economic substance to inflate basis, overstate depreciation, and bilk the IRS. If anyone doubted whether House Ways and Means had a compelling oversight reason to see Trump's tax returns, here you go. And so that's important because, as you say, the administration has really been pushing back on whether or not the committee will have access to those tax returns. And a key piece of their argument is that the committee doesn't have a legitimate legislative purpose in seeing the tax returns, that they're just, you know, they're embarking on a political vendetta against the president. And what Hemmel is pointing out there is that it's not that the committee was lacking for reasons, right? You can come up with, you know, 50 good ones, but the president has just given them another one on Twitter. So we'll see if this has any effect on the litigation.
Yeah, what I see from one of the accounts when this story was circulating the other night that Republicans were saying, well, we knew that he lost money. We knew that he staged a comeback, which I think is a reasonable response, trying to remember the overall narrative of Donald Trump's career. But if you read the Times story in detail, and I listened to the Times reporters talking about it, you know, they were saying, yes, you know, we knew that he had lost money in the 1990s, but we had assumed, everyone had assumed, that in the 1980s, when he really rose to prominence as this billionaire master of the universe, that that he was profitable. And what these documents show is that he was never profitable, that he was never making any money, and also that he was losing this massive amount of money. And some of the details are really extraordinary, including the fact that he apparently lost more than any other American.
It was right, taxes. Right.
But while his father was always making money, his father, Fred, always was profitable, while his son was always losing money. The only thing that his father, Fred, lost money on were the deals that he did with Donald J. Trump. Okay, so let's just go on here to the other breaking stories here, and I want to get to the executive privilege issue. You know, this letter that came out, 700 federal prosecutors signing a letter saying that if Donald Trump was not the president, he would have been charged with obstruction of justice. And this includes former associates of Rudy Giuliani. And, of course, Trump World is brushing that off as this is, you know, it is a bit, you know, liberal special interest group. But it is, I don't know, I have to say, as a non-lawyer, just the volume of federal prosecutors and the definitive nature of their statements. And then the Washington Post went and talked to many of them. And there seems to be a consensus that in their mind, this was not even a close call.
Yeah, I was really interested to see that. My colleague, Paul Rosenzweig, who writes for us at Lawfare and who was a prosecutor on Ken Starr's team during the Clinton investigation, Bill Clinton, that is, also signed it. I was struck by it because, as you say, it is a truly remarkable amount of people. I believe when the letter was first released, they had maybe 250, 300. And now, as you say, it's up to 700. I will say I was initially somewhat leery of the idea of a bunch of former prosecutors sort of signing on and saying that they felt there was a case in an instance where Mueller had declined to reach the decision of whether to bring a case when, you know, the evidence that they have is only the evidence that the rest of us have. But you are absolutely right that it is an incredibly striking statement. And I think the value that it has is in, as many of the signers seem to indicate, is in pushing back against the way that Attorney General Bill Barr has characterized Mueller's findings. Because the way that Barr has talked about them is to suggest that Mueller did not reach a conclusion on whether or not the president likely obstructed justice. Not saying this outright, but sort of suggesting that it's because the evidence just might not have been there. And I would argue that that is not what the report states. And if you read the report, you can see quite clearly that there are instances where Mueller really does seem to think that the president likely committed obstruction. And I think this letter by all these former prosecutors really, really drives that home.
The Democrats, of course, are still flailing in figuring out how to respond to all of this. And you have Nancy Pelosi saying the president is trying to goad them into impeachment. Am I right in reading your, and it's always dangerous to read anybody's, you know, try to, you know, predict what they're thinking based on their Twitter feed, but I'm getting a sense that you are a little frustrated with the Democrats in Congress and their reluctance to move ahead with impeachment.
Yep, that's absolutely right. And I have been thinking of the, you know, the old phrase, I'm not a member of any organized party, I'm a Democrat. I wouldn't say that of myself, but it's been on my mind. And yes, I think that I have been baffled, I think is a fair way to say it, that the Democrats are basically going full bore against Bill Barr, suggesting that they should impeach him. They're voting this morning, the House Judiciary Committee, on whether to hold him in contempt. I believe some Democratic members have sent a bar complaint to the D.C. and Virginia bars over the attorney general. And at the same time are arguing, well, we don't really want to impeach Donald Trump. As Nancy Pelosi says, he's, you know, he wants us to impeach him. And look, I will say I'm not a political strategist. I am not a pollster. I don't know whether the political calculation here on the part of the Democrats makes any sense. What I will say as a sort of as a moral matter in and of itself, I believe very strongly, and I've argued with my colleague Susan Hennessy, that the conduct described in the Mueller report is so astonishing that it functionally demands impeachment by Congress, that it is a constitutional responsibility on the part of the House of Representatives to impeach, and perhaps on the part of the Senate to convict, but at least to begin impeachment proceedings. And that if Congress doesn't do that, the constitutional system breaks down. And so you're absolutely right that I'm extremely frustrated at the Democrats' sort of failure to, I think I can fairly say failure to take that constitutional duty seriously.
Well, there is the argument, and I know you've also addressed this, the argument that there's something fundamentally anti-democratic about the impeachment process. This is the duly elected president of the United States, and that there would be, you know, a political downside to members of the House going ahead with this impeachment proceeding. So is impeachment inherently anti-democratic?
Sure. So I've been thinking about this because Nate Silver, who runs 538, has made this argument a couple of times on Twitter, and it struck me as a really interesting counterargument. And it's an argument that the Democrats have made to some extent, sort of saying, well, we have an election coming up. Steny Hoyer made this argument immediately after the Mueller report came out. You know, we have an election coming up. Why don't we just wait until the election? The people can vote him out of office. So my counterargument would be, I agree that impeachment is anti-democratic. It is true that impeachment is functionally a mechanism to remove the president who has been elected by the people of the United States. That said, as George Conway rightly points out, the president would be removed by the duly elected representatives of the people. So it's not completely anti-democratic, right? But I do think it is important to understand that just because something is maximally democratic doesn't mean that it is the right thing to do. The example I've been turning over in my head is, you know, imagine if the president, he's made the comment that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, right, and it wouldn't make a difference. If the president shot someone on Fifth Avenue, and, you know, 75% of the public, just I'm exaggerating as much as I can, 75% of the public says, that's fine, don't impeach him. Does that mean that it is wrong for Congress to impeach? I would argue that it is anti-democratic to some extent for Congress to impeach, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. And the reason is that there can be constitutional incentives that have to do with protecting the integrity of the American Republic that are not 100% all democracy all the time. And that's fine. That's why we have a constitution.
This is interesting you bring this up, because I'm involved in all kinds of organizations that have the word democracy in it. And every once in a while, somebody will raise their hand and say, exactly what do we mean by the word democracy? Shouldn't this really be, aren't we really talking about, you know, a constitutional republic? Because what you've just articulated is the difference between a pure democracy and a constitutional republic, a nation of laws, right? Because you could certainly argue, okay, well, 70% of Americans want a president who has just shot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, then that's the way it should be, right? That is democracy in action. You know, the people should get what they want, and they should get it good and hard. As opposed to that, there are norms that are not subject to majority opinion or majority rule. So the word democracy tends to get thrown around a lot, but I think it's important to point out that we in fact have never been structured as a strict democracy.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And I think that keeping that in mind is particularly important right now, when we're in a situation where it seems like a certain proportion of the population, if they had their way, would support policies that would strip protections from other members of the population, right? And this is what James Madison writes about in the Federalist Papers, that you will always have this trouble in a democracy where you're trying to prevent the tyranny of the majority. And what I would argue is that when we say, I don't think it's entirely right to say, you know, well, we're not a democracy, we're a constitutional republic, because what we really are is, I would say that we are a constitutional republic by way of being a democracy. And that doesn't mean that we're not a democracy, and it doesn't mean that those constitutional aspects of our governance negate the democratic aspects. It means that those aspects of our government exist together, sometimes in tension, but there's a reason why the system is built the way it is. And the check of impeachment should be understood as a big step, in a way, a terrible step, precisely because it negates a presidential election, but that doesn't mean it should never be taken.
The point that I find the most compelling, and it's not necessarily an argument for impeachment, but the concern on the part of Democrats that if they push this too hard, it will backfire, I think is maybe misplaced somewhat because of the ability of these televised hearings to change public opinion. And I think that's just something that and I'm surprised they don't more fully grasp this. And you pointed out, see, this is why I prep by reading your tweets again, that there are details in that Mueller report that are fascinating, that I'm sure that nobody really understands at this point. For example, as you point out, Donald Trump asked Mike Flynn to go find Hillary's emails. Michael Flynn then goes and talks to this guy, Peter Smith, who tries to pay people he thinks are Russians to obtain these emails. And that's just one of these, just one tiny little detail from volume one of the Mueller report. You kind of wonder if that was expressed in televised hearings, whether there would be a portion of the public going, damn, I had no idea that was going on. That sounds pretty collusion-y to me. And so the belief that, that this thing has been completely and totally litigated, or that it's used up all of this bandwidth, I think misses the fact that the vast majority of Americans, probably like 99.8%, have not read this 450-page report.
I saw a poll the other day that said that 3% of Americans had read the entire report, which, to be completely honest with you, sounds way too high
to me. Yeah, 2% were lying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, this is my job to read the Mueller report, and it took me a week and a half to completely get through it and digest it carefully. And I think it's exactly right that I don't know whether beginning an impeachment inquiry would backfire electorally. Like I said, I want to be humble about the range of my own knowledge here, and I'm not a strategist. But I do agree completely that people don't have the time to read a 450-page legal document. And it's also not reasonable to expect them to have the time. People have jobs. People have responsibilities. And the benefit of televised hearings, of having witnesses come in, say if they ask Corey Lewandowski to come in and testify about Trump's efforts to basically use him as a messenger to get Sessions to start exerting control over the Mueller investigation, that would, or could perhaps, have an effect in a much greater way than releasing the report all at once, because it's presented in a way that is more accessible to people.
Yeah. So will we see Bob Mueller testifying in front of Congress, do you think?
I would be surprised if we don't.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the president has given indications that he is against it. It is certainly true that Mueller is currently a DOJ employee, and so perhaps the Justice Department could stand in the way. That said, I don't think Mueller is going to be a Justice Department employee for very long. He's in the wrapping things up stage. And also, if the Justice Department is really intransigent and he really wants to testify right away, I don't see why he couldn't just quit and show up.
Yeah, no,
because at that point, they have no leverage.
And that will be high drama. I think you really do have to go back to the Iran-Contra hearings or Watergate hearings to come up with a moment on television that would be this, would have this kind of an audience. Okay, so finally, I understand that this is a moving target. The White House, and this is the first time they've done this, the White House formally asserted executive privilege over Bob Mueller's report. This is the first use of executive authority in this latest confrontation with Congress. The Assistant Attorney General writes a letter to Congress that Trump had asserted privilege over the entirety of the subpoenaed materials. And he writes that the Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler's push to hold the Attorney General in contempt had terminated their negotiations over what materials lawmakers would be allowed to view from Mueller's investigation. So once again, you have an escalation of all of this. And for the first time, this assertion of executive privilege. I am not a lawyer. I still do not understand. How do you release the information in one context and say we're not asserting executive privilege, but then when Congress asks for the exact same stuff you've already waived your right and executive privilege on, say, no, now we're asserting it. So I don't get any of that.
Sure. So let me say a couple things. And I will start by saying that I am not an executive privilege expert and don't want to pretend to be one. So first off, I will say the White House also exerted executive privilege over documents requested by the Judiciary Committee relating to Don McGahn. And that took place yesterday on May 7th. So then, now back to the asserting of privilege over the Mueller report. It's a little confusing if you read the letter carefully, both the letter to the Judiciary Committee and a letter that Bill Barr actually sent to the president this morning. What it seems like is going on is the Justice Department is saying we're exerting what they're calling a they're calling a protective exertion of executive privilege. They're basically saying, look, the House Judiciary Committee asked Bill Barr to hand over the full unredacted Mueller report. Bill Barr didn't do that. So the House is currently set to vote to hold Bill Barr, is currently set to vote to hold Bill Barr in contempt. And so what these letters are saying is basically to keep Bill Barr from being held in contempt, what we're going to do is exert privilege over everything. And that will buy us time to look through the documents and figure out what we really want to exert privilege over down the line. This sounds kind of crazy, but this is not the first time that it's happened. If you read the letter, the Justice Department points to a very similar memo produced by Attorney General Janet Reno to Bill Clinton.
On yesterday's podcast, we talked with Rachel Bade, who is a Washington Post congressional reporter, who said that House Republicans are just furious about all of this. They're just infuriated and frustrated, which is certainly understandable. But I wonder, yes, these are maybe short-term tactics, but this does feel like it's building towards something. And even though Nancy Pelosi has been resisting your call to open impeachment hearings, it just seems like every day we are inching closer to it. It becomes an inevitability because the tensions are so great, the defiance is so great, and this does seem to be what Trump's folks want. I mean, Trump's folks do seem to want to push them into impeachment. Doesn't it feel that way?
I don't know if they'd want to, I would say they want to push them into impeachment on the congressional issues, but I absolutely agree that that is where it's headed. And if you look at the original articles of impeachment drafted against Nixon, one of the articles which actually wasn't adopted was saying that Nixon had engaged in contempt of Congress by refusing to hand over documents. Congress really doesn't take this kind of thing kindly. There's a very good argument, which I think both Pelosi and Nadler have voiced to some extent, that what Trump is really doing, what this pattern of activity adds up to, is delegitimizing the authority of Congress as a coordinate branch of government. And I certainly agree that the longer this goes on, the more egregious it gets. And for those Democrats, and for that matter, those Republicans who looked at the Mueller report and said, it's not worth it, there's not enough here, it's, this doesn't merit an impeachment inquiry. The thing about Donald Trump is the more time you give him, the more egregious activities he'll engage in. And he really does seem to be stacking the deck against himself here, whether it's strategic or not.
No, I agree. Quinta Jurecek is the managing editor of Lawfare blog. And thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.